The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 14, Episode 13. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing four tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Kyle Harrison, Dominic Eagle, and Micah Edwards. Tonight, we'll hear stories of entrancing enclaves, terrified towns, cemetery callers, and macabre memories. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail, so lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show's about to begin. In our last episode together, we talked about horror of the Victorian age. Now, let's talk about horrors that may have been around since the Victorian age. See, while stories of the bloodthirsty and dead have been around since time immemorial, it wasn't until the late 19th century that we got the vampires as we know it today. Before, they were vicious, nasty, horrific bloodsuckers that would stop at nothing to get what they needed. But now, they do the same thing, just usually in a way that's more presentable. But be it Dracula, Lestat, Edward Cullen, or our good old Count Orlok, best thing to do is stake hard and stake 'em good. And if they're not a vampire, well, at least you try. We begin tonight with Mr. Kyle Harrison, who's brought to you a lovely little tale of a society in which the vampires aren't hiding anything. In fact, they seem very generous and caring. Unless, of course, they are hiding something. But they wouldn't do a thing like that, would they? Without further ado, I present to you Blood Lottery. I can't say I recall when I came to the compound. It almost feels like a dream that I've been living, even though the circumstances are far from ideal. I remember being sick, hardly being able to stand. My hands were shaky, and I knew I was going to die. Something ethereal rescued me, or at least that's how I remember seeing it at first. Lately, I've been seeing a lot of things differently, though, so it might be the memories are false, and my brain needs time to pick up the pieces. I know this is an odd way to start things off, so let me backtrack a bit and explain what the facility is for, why it is that this place can be considered both a blessing and a curse for anyone who finds themselves there. The short answer is because of the owners. They aren't human, you see. They're vampires, the ones you hear about in legends and see in old horror movies. Pale, tall bloodsuckers that embody everything dark and evil that exists in this sad world. It's not like they hide the fact that they're vampires either. Everyone knows it. They're the ones that keep us fed, house us, and provide everything that we need here. And it's for that reason that we're here. In exchange, they offer us the privilege of being placed on the blood lottery. According to our masters, this is an efficient system that maintains balance between our lives and theirs. Clearly, they deserve to be in power because they're the ones that provide us with everything that we need. We were all told the same affirmations, day in and day out. The masters should be praised. They gave us life and therefore can take it away. Until a few weeks ago, this sort of thing was in my brain and was as common as a prayer might be. Mindless chants I fed to myself to keep myself from being too free. Freedom, you see, it comes with a cost, and mine isn't one I can even say I managed to obtain for myself. For that, I have my wife Kate to thank. We met here in the compound during an art class. One of the senior staff, a vampire named Chicory, was teaching us how blood could be interpreted as sacred for the source of our designs, and Kate and I wound up being our partners. Back then, we were both under the spell of the vampires. Chicory was seen as a god to us. But even gods can fall short of glory when love starts to grow. I remember passing the blade to my art partner, focusing on her radiant skin. It seemed a shame that this gorgeous woman was about to cut herself to the very bone, all in the name of spectacle. Part of me wanted to watch the blood trickle from her neck and see Chicory go wild with hunger just at the mere sight of the red body fluid. But as she pricked her neck, I told her to stop and asked that she give me the blade instead. "A portrait of beauty shouldn't be marred," I said. It was a lame compliment, but all of us had learned to speak this way around the vampires. They were from a different time and insisted chivalry and colonial language were more appropriate than anything we remembered from our life before. If we even remembered our life before. As I let the blade work its magic on my body, my open, bloody chest, now a canvas for Chicory to work with, the pain coursing through my body sent ripples down my mind. I didn't understand, at first, the feeling, but as I cut deeper, I recognized the sensation was memories returning to me. When I came to this compound, I was told I couldn't remember the world before. We all were. We thought the world to be dead, you see. Our vampire masters had saved us from a world that we as humans couldn't exist in any longer. Except the memories I had weren't of that sort of life at all. When the blade hit my face and I jabbed it deep against my cheek, I saw that I once had a family. The life was happy and pleasant. And it was with that strike against my body I first experienced cracks in my faith. When the session ended, I asked for Kate to let me be partners with her the next time and we went our separate ways. I returned to my dorms, trying to chant the same mantras all of us were told about the old world. The blood lottery, we were told, was a gracious sacrifice. To be taken and fed to one of the old ones was the greatest privilege anyone could ask for. Our bodies are food. It's nature. They honor us by not treating us as prey, as cattle. But when I sat up in my bed and looked at the wounds on my face, the way Chicory treated me bothered me immensely. The affirmations felt like lies. My master had attempted to feed on me in front of the entire art class, unable to control himself as the blood flowed. It didn't matter if I was in pain or if I didn't even survive the event. That surely meant that they weren't telling the truth about the way they treated us. At least that's what I was beginning to feel. It was only a modest inkling of unease, but I couldn't shake it, and I was determined to make sure Kate could feel it too. Over the next few months, I went out of my way to get closer to her and the coven she was associated with. Here in the facility, there are five. It was supposed to make us feel like we were part of something greater than ourselves, but honestly, as I started to learn more about Kate, I realized that this was merely to keep us on a tight chain and to watch us at all times. Our masters had arranged for us to get to know each other. Some advanced algorithms they used said we would be a perfect match for one another. We were supposed to be thankful. Of course, at the time, I didn't know about this. I was unaware of how much my life was beyond my control. The cracks didn't start to form until they took Kate from me. I suppose it's ironic that their own downfall is a result of the very experiment that they'd created. They thought by controlling my life, they would subdue anything that I had questioned. For a while, I was happy. I even proposed to Kate, all by their design, of course. But what they couldn't have calculated was how much our love would grow. I guess that's something that they forgot because of their immortality. Kate and I had a few years together where life was good, or at least what I thought was my life being good. We'd go about our daily affairs, unquestionably loyal to the masters. We'd chant their mantras in our heads and tell each other we were so lucky to be under their care. The world outside's fierce. The world outside's brutal. And here we're safe. And here we have control. But the truth was, it's all just smoke and mirrors. I first saw glimpses of it when a close friend of Kate refused to go to the lottery. We were in the dining hall, a large auditorium where the entire facility ate, and we were watching the massive screen to see whose name would be next for the lottery. Jillian. Kate told me she was a school teacher. When her face came up in the video, all of us began to cheer. But Jillian's face was one of abject terror. I didn't understand that at the time. She was being chosen for a great honor, I thought. The chance to give our lifeblood to the masters was the greatest sacrifice any of us could give. So many of us wanted to be picked. I remember watching her slowly getting up from her seat, trying to remain calm. She kept repeating one phrase. I won't go. Pick someone else. I won't go. Pick someone else. She got louder and louder, and I saw some of the lower vampires begin to take notice. Her eyes weren't friendly anymore. They swooped in and subdued her just as she began to run. The entire auditorium was confused and alarmed by the outburst. Then we heard a chime from above. It was Lysander, one of the old ones. Everyone listened when he talked. He was an original vampire, some claimed. The one that had started the blood lottery. I guess in many respects, he was our guide. I still hear that speech ringing in my head. At the time, it sounded like a voice from heaven. It's very disappointing when we encounter ungratefulness on display. This child had a chance to show how much she values her life here, and yet she wanted to squander it instead. Would she rather be cast out to the cold, to die and starve in the world above? I think we know who the real victim is here, my friends. This poor, delusional woman thinks she knows better than we do. Take her screams as an example, and remember that the reason we control you is because we love you. We want you to be safe from others who don't value life as we do. Others who will simply devour and destroy. We don't want that. We want order. Balance. That's what we're trying to achieve here, Lysander said. His voice cracked across the room like thunder. The crowd cheered. I remember Kate looking worried. It was the first hint that something was wrong. We'd never questioned the masters. They were the reason we were alive. But she was disturbed by what had happened to her friend, and so she began to ask questions. I remember being confused and worried for her. As days slipped into weeks, I couldn't tell if she was still herself. She was distant, secretive. The night before I lost her, she asked me if I really was sure the masters had our best interest in mind. Don't you find it strange, she said, that we can't recall much about our lives before we came here? How's that possible? Did they take our memories from us? I hate that I gave a canned response, but I was frightened by her. You should be thankful they saved us, Kate. The masters took trauma from us. I would rather not remember any of the people that I knew dying because of the way the world is up there. At least here we're safe. But we can't be sure the world is terrible, can we? I mean, none of us have ever been to the surface. The facility is all we've ever known. They've kept us under their thumb for ages. You act like it's an oppressive system. They fed us, gave us shelter, work. Our lives have meaning now, Kate, I argued. My voice was shaky as I said those words because I didn't want to admit some of what she was saying was making sense. But to my shame, I humiliated her that night and told her I thought she was selfish and foolish. Even if it's not real, this is the only life I know now. This is what I want, I insisted. I tried to propose to her that night to make things right. I'd been thinking about it for some time. But she said she needed more time to be sure. The next day, her name came up on the blood lottery. She turned to me in the auditorium and grabbed my arm. Leon, don't let them take me. Don't let this happen, she said frantically. I was at a loss for words. I didn't know what to do. Her eyes filled with panic as two vampires came down the stairs to escort her to the launching facility. They'll kill me, Leon. I'm being silenced. Don't you see that? It's because of what happened last night. They were listening. I stood up, guiding her through the crowd to the edge of the room. Maybe we can reason with them. If you just cooperate and show them that you're sorry, this can all go away, I told her. It was a naive response to a problem I knew was spiraling out of control. She looked ashamed to be near me. We have to fight. Don't you see that? They're going to kill me, and your response is just to play nice? Kate snapped. Kate, they're the ones in control here. What am I supposed to do? I asked defensively as the vampires flanked her on either side. Be the husband you want to be and protect your wife, she said as they tried to grab her, and she kept deflecting them until at last they gripped her arm so hard it looked like it almost turned blue. Sir, return to your seat, one vampire told me. I saw fear in her eyes. She didn't want to die, and at that moment I realized I didn't want her to either. I tried to reach for her, and the vampire pushed me back so hard that I fell. They dragged her out as Kate kicked and screamed, and I tried to stand up and run after her, but four more young vampires stood in my way. It was pointless to try and push past. I watched helplessly as my love was escorted to the elevator, and behind me the group cheered as they launched her to the feeding platform. And I was unable to do anything to stop it from happening. For the next few days, I was in a spiral of depression and doubt. I didn't know if I was even alive still, to be honest. Without my wife, I was nothing. I wasn't even sure I wanted to be alive. I kept looking at the lottery board, waiting for my name to be called. I wanted them to take me to bleed the way Kate had. It felt like the only escape I had left was death. I didn't snap out of it and do something until I learned another ugly truth. I was sitting and smoking with a few friends, trying to drown my sorrows with cigarettes and booze, when Frank commented, I don't normally say this, Leon, but it's a shame that Kate got picked for the lottery. I tried to remember how I knew Frank. It was from the clinic, I recalled. We went there almost once a month for a shot to keep us vaccinated from the diseases of the upper world that could still hurt us. Now, what do you mean by that? I asked. He took off his glasses and rubbed them nervously. Well, her condition. It's usually not common for them to do that, he said with a slight smirk. Her condition? I asked softly, the room spinning as he announced casually that Kate had been 2 months pregnant. I had just told her a few days before her name was called. Usually they don't ask for a woman in the first trimester. I think it was probably a mistake. I stood up and told him to stop talking, the room spinning. Suddenly, I needed to puke. That's just what I did next, and I announced I needed to go home. Do you need a drive? Another asked me. I can walk, I told them. As I stumbled home in the dark, my head felt faint and my heart heavy. Pregnant. She'd been pregnant. I was supposed to be the father. But because of my cowardice, I didn't even have the gall to do anything to stop them from taking her. I don't even know how I made it through the streets, but I found a bridge and considered jumping. To die by such a fall would surely be better than waiting for the day my name was picked for this sick game. It was at that moment, as I stared into death, a new purpose was born inside me. I could see Kate's reflection from beyond, instructing me, telling me that I needed to seek revenge. I dedicated myself to getting better at my craft. I was already doing portraits for the lower tiers. Helping them to view their supposed beauty made my name spread across the chiefs of the sector. Soon, vampires from across the realm were asking to have their likeness painted. It's a job I took pleasure in, painting them and making them think that I truly cared about their kind. It was the fastest way to get noticed by the old ones, and that was my ultimate goal. I wanted to stake the old one that had fed on my wife and unborn child. I kept a stake handy, too, right in my coat pocket. They never checked me, never assumed I would be anything besides a mindless drone. I must have played my part so well because it only took a month for Lysander to request my services. His voice didn't ring like a chant in my head anymore, so when I heard him call my name from the auditorium, it sounded like nails on a chalkboard. This ancient beast had worked so hard to control me, to make me suffer by taking my Kate away. And now, at long last, I was going to run him through with a wooden stake. I had to be careful, though. I had to be patient. He took me to the central palace, where most of the old ones stay. It overlooked the entire facility. Here I saw the feeding of our kind firsthand for the first time as a senior chief escorted me to Lysander's lair. Humans were lined up, naked and trembling in the cold, as vampires prepared to feed on them. They were tattooed like cattle might be, brought from different corners of our massive community. I'm not sure why this surprised me. I had always known there was nothing truly special about the blood lottery. They were tricking us, making us feel simply special, to be placed here and used as fodder for their insatiable hunger. I clenched my fists and focused on the next elevator. I was almost there. Lysander's office was almost at the ground level. I was so high above the entire community that I felt like I was flying. He and his staff were observing everything with constant video feeds. Another reminder that we were always being watched. I don't know why I expected to see a wrinkled and crumpled ancient man. This vampire was an immortal. He still looked exactly like the youth he had been centuries ago. It disgusted me to stand there and realize I looked old enough to be his father. So many years squandered pandering to their whims. All because I believed they were protecting us. "You're the artist," he asked. "Yes, my lord. I was told you requested a portrait." Lysander smiled thinly. His cold eyes studied me the way a predator might towards its prey. "I have a different assignment for you. Your work has become so well known in our lands, I think your art might also inspire the next generation to see what the world above truly is," he explained. "I'm not sure I understand," I admitted. "I want you to paint a landscape, you silly child. This tower we're sitting in connects to the ground, the world you once called your own. Many of your kind often wondered what it looks like. They even dared to question if our methods are correct to keep you safe," Lysander said. I could see his fingernails suddenly sharpening like claws. "They need to see the world for the dark and bleak place that it is," he said, as he took his other free hand and placed it behind my neck. "But before you do that, I need to be sure you're fully under my spell. Surrender your blood to me," he commanded. He was so close to me I could feel his breath on my face. Sweat was glistening on my face. I wanted him vulnerable, so I inclined my neck toward him and pretended to offer myself as a feeder. His fangs elongated and his eyes turned white as snow. I knew it was now or never. As his fangs pierced my neck, so too did my stake slam through where his heart should be. I heard the ancient vampire gasp in shock, stumbling backward and looking at where I had jammed the wooden stake into his body. He was about to call for help, and I tackled him to the ground, using his shock to my advantage to finish the job. I had sharpened the stakes to do two jobs. If the heart wasn't successful, I knew another method of disposing of these creatures. I took it out of his chest and slammed it into his own head, lopping it off with one fell swoop. The creature of the night shrieked and cried out, hardly able to do more than gasp for a final breath, as his body withered. When I stood over him, though, I felt no sense of accomplishment. My cape was still gone, and I knew my life would soon be over when the guards returned and saw what I had done. I stared out at the facility, wishing I could do something to save any other person out there. Then I focused on the private elevator just past his suite, the one he claimed would take me to the surface. I stepped inside and pressed for the top floor, leaving the remnants of the ancient corpse behind and focusing on what I was to learn. Deep in my gut, I knew what to expect, but the spell wasn't completely broken until the elevator stopped, and I stepped out onto a lush green hill. The facility was built on a mountainside, and beyond I could see a veritable paradise. Green grass, blooming trees, winding rivers, blue skies. There was no apocalypse here. No sickness they had saved us from. I'd anticipated this, suspected that every single part of our existence was a lie. But to see it here with my own eyes had brought me to tears. I fell to my knees, not knowing what to do or how to save anyone below. Would they even believe me? Would they still be under the thrall of these immortal monsters? I knew why Lysander and the others controlled so much of our lives now. If I had been part of the hypnotic followers, I too would have seen the world as they wanted me to see. I had Kate to thank for realizing this world was still beautiful. Her death gave me freedom, and I knew better than to waste the opportunity to find others who could stop these vampires and change the lives of countless others. I don't know how far I walked. Eventually, there was a highway, and a man took me to a ranger station. When I gave my name and several others I knew, I soon learned that there were missing person files on all of us, thousands in the area. "What happened to you out there?" the ranger asked, noting my terrible appearance. I had no idea if you would believe, or if anyone will when they hear of this tale. But I don't ask this simply for others to take my word for it. We must save the others. We must bring these creatures to justice and protect our kind before their influence spreads elsewhere. Only by realizing the world is not what you think it is can we ever hope for it to be better. I learned that the hard way, trapped in a system I never imagined I should question. Don't make my mistakes. Question your reality. You'll likely find a very ugly truth buried not too deep beneath the surface. I hope you enjoyed Blood Lottery by Kyle Harrison, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Kyle-Harrison. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/KYLE-HARRISON. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. Never lie to your cattle. All it does is make them ungrateful. I mean, who do you think they are? Murdering their overlords when they get close to finding the truth? Next thing you know, they're stealing lunches out of the break room. Dominic Eagle brings us our next story, in which a town appears to be concerned about recent events. Well, maybe you would be too, if your quiet little town had suddenly plagued by a series of, murders. Let's find out a little bit more about what happens when a small town finds itself having to deal with more than it can chew. Without further ado, I present to you No Post. Amazon delivery, the man at the door said. Hello? He shouldn't have been there, for there's no postal service in our town. And so I fetched my crossbow before answering the door. We do not receive letters or parcels in this isolated place. Severed from the rest of the world, we've always been content with our solitude. Well, no, that's a lie. It's a quiet town, and it's always been, but we weren't always so afraid. In the face of extreme adversity, humans strive to survive, not live. And that's exactly the position in which my neighbors and I have found ourselves in for the past 5 years. We've chosen not the lives we want, but only the ones we can have. It all started in 2019 with a terrible winter and an inexplicable homicide. Cause of death? I asked the responding officer. You better look inside, detective, the police officer replied, motioning to the open doorway. I sighed, trudging through the dense blanket of snow, coating the front yard of the property, lit only by the flashing red and blue lights of the parked police cars. A frown spread across my face as I observed the splintered wooden front door. Before I could even step inside the property, I knew it to be a case unlike any I'd solved in the town since moving there 10 years prior. There had only been 2 murders in the time that I'd been detective, and both cases were domestic homicide. But this was something different, and I could feel that in my bones as I crossed the threshold onto the property. Several officers were gathered in the living room, and a scene of ghastliness was illuminated by a stark white crime scene spotlight. The body was that of Lizzie Carter, but there was little left to identify her. If I hadn't already known the lady and her place of residence, I doubt I would have been able to distinguish any of her features. Her face had been reduced to mush, a bloody, brutalized pile of mush, and what remained of her body below the neck was withered and emaciated. Now, I'd spoken to Lizzie Carter only a few days prior in a local grocery store. She was a small, frail lady in her late 80s, but she was by no means unhealthy. For her age, she was in wonderful physical health, and so it stood to reason that her decrepit, shriveled form had to be the result of a horrendous death that she had suffered. But who could do such a thing? Who could do such a thing? And to such a sweet, innocent old lady? That was going to be the most puzzling aspect of the case, I realized. Lizzie Carter had no relatives. She lived alone, and she didn't make enemies. This was no domestic case. Somebody had forced entry into her room and slaughtered her in the most horrendous way imaginable. Exsanguinated, Officer Lucy Harper said, pulling me free from my daze. That's what the specialist said. You mean, I started. Drained of blood, she clarified, nodding. Entirely. Every last drop in her body is gone. Other than, well... Harper gestured to the bloody mess across the corpse's outer body and most of the demolished living room. I've never seen anything like this, Lucy, I said. Nobody has, Lucy sighed. Chief's calling the state guys. Oh, come on, I huffed. He's not going to put this entirely on you, Joe, Lucy said. This ain't some small-town case. Something horrendous happened here, and I don't think it had anything to do with Lizzie in particular, do you? No, I answered. Nothing Lizzie did would have warranted a reaction like this. But I don't want state guys burying their nose in my case, Lucy. I can do this. I want to do this for Lizzie. Lucy sighed. Well, Chief's already encouraged him to drive on down on Wednesday. That'll give us 2 days. 2 days, I scoffed. They're in no hurry, then. We need to act now so this freak doesn't strike again. Again? Lucy asked, startled. I nodded. A killing like this? Out of the blue? It's only the start. I was right, but I had no idea of the terror that was truly unfolding. Before the state police would arrive, I'd understand every last thing, and there'd be nothing I could do about it. I investigated that scene until dawn, scouring every inch of the house for evidence. It was around 6 a.m. when Lucy returned to peel me away and that I finally found something of note. Bed, Joe, she sighed. You've been at this all night and you're practically collapsing on your feet. Look at this, Lucy, I said, brandishing something white and glistening. Is that a... She began, I nodded. A tooth. It's huge, she said. Not human. Nope, doesn't look like any animal fangs I've ever seen either, I said. Can't believe the first team missed it. Where was it, she asked. That's the oddest thing, I said. It was placed atop Lucy's pillow. Well, it certainly wasn't hers, Lucy said. Nope, I said. She had dentures, but I think we would have noticed ones as large as this. Seems conclusive that it belongs to the killer, Lucy said. Nothing about this feels conclusive, I sighed. A gargantuan tooth neatly placed on a pillow leaves us with more questions than we had when we entered. Well, let's get back to the station, Lucy pleaded, heading out of the room. Chief wants to speak to you. I exhaled slowly, following my friend and colleague down the stairs. I was mulling over the details of the case, striving to come up with some form of explanation before speaking to the chief, something that would impress him enough to call off the state troopers. I was desperate to prove myself. Joe, Lucy said, stopping in her tracks at the door of the living room. What? Where? What's up? I asked, pushing past her. The answer was inside the room, or rather, it wasn't. Lucy's body was gone. All that remained in the room, which was slowly being drenched in sunlight of the early dawn, were broken furnishings and blood-soaked floorboards. Get in the car, I said. Call it in. Lucy nodded, speaking into her radio, as we hurriedly sprinted to her vehicle. At that point, we were thinking of a killer returning to claim their prize. Our brains couldn't even conceive of the true horror that was burgeoning beneath the surface of our once sleepy town. A town that was about to change forever. What are you talking about? Chief Anderson barked as we stepped into his office 10 minutes later. How in the heck does a dead body get up and leave? I think the killer returned to the scene, Chief, I said. And you let him get away? The man spat, growling at me. For crying out loud, Thompson, fix this! Oh well, I said. And you, Harper, get your butt out there with Carlson and Smith. They're chasing their tails out there, and I'm at my wit's end. Anderson cried, voice breaking. We'll solve this, Chief, Lucy promised. You'd better, because I got sneery state pricks breathing down my neck, the chief said, slamming his fist on the desk. I'm supposed to be watching my blood pressure, and it's just one thing after another today, I swear. Relax, Chief, I said, pushing the extent of his often lax approach towards me. We don't need state detectives. I got this. Harper's got this. We've all got this. Anderson angrily scooped a fang from the table and waved it maniacally before our eyes. You've got it all under control, do you? What the heck is... Sir, a voice interrupted as the door opened. It was Bradshaw, and she looked white as a sheet. And no more bad news, Bradshaw, I swear to... Anderson began. We've got another case, Bradshaw gulped. Another? Anderson started, eyes widening. Don't say what you're about to say. Mass homicide at Fire Park or... No! The chief bellowed, slamming the table. Thompson! Harper! We're going, chief, Lucy said. We followed Bradshaw out of the chief's office and mumbled quick thank yous for him saving us. Save the gratitude, Bradshaw muttered. The guy who called in the incident, he said that some things, I don't know. Just prepare yourself. Lucy and I nodded, both still fueled by the adrenaline of the night before, and I believed I had seen the full extent of this killer's horrific methods. But I was still innocent to the true meaning of terror. I hadn't even begun to see the levels of depravity to which this terrorizer could stoop. Lucy and I drove to the scene of the crime, joining several other officers, who looked even paler than the night before. What's the situation, Carlson? I asked, stepping onto the front yard of a 5 Parkerson Road. It's worse than Lizzie, Carlson said quietly. So much worse. There was a teenager shivering on the front porch under a blanket, being watched by a couple of officers, and I strolled over to him even before thinking about entering the crime scene. Hi, I'm Detective Thompson, I said, but you can call me Joe. What happened here, kid? What's your name?
I'm Sam.
The kid wheezed.
We were having a house party last night, and... Well,
are you the son of Richard and Grace Hull? I asked, realizing I recognized the house.
The boy gulped, nodding. They're on the way home, but I don't think they'll want to go inside. I think they'll want to burn it all down.
Before I go inside to investigate, I started. Is there anything you might be able to say that could help with the investigation? Sam looked up at me with somber, bloodshot eyes. His skin was so pale, so terribly, terribly pale, and he kept shooting fearful gazes at the sky as if he were unimaginably afraid of something that the officers and I couldn't possibly have hoped to understand. And at that moment in time, he would have been right.
"They killed everyone but me," he whispered.
I sighed, believing that we might have found our prime suspect already, given that he lived only one block away from Lizzie Carter's house. A drunken teenager on a killing spree. Pieces of the puzzle were missing, but the edgy, unhinged boy filled my gut with a dreadful feeling. "Take him down to the station, Smith," I said to one of the officers. The boy's eyes narrowed into slits, and he hissed like a wild animal. The look he offered was unlike anything a human could cast. It wasn't even something primal. There was nothing animal about the kid. He looked like a corpse.
"Don't," he growled.
"Sam, please don't resist," I sighed. "Let's not make this unpleasant for your mother and father when they arrive, okay?"
"Unpleasant?"
Sam asked, curling his lips into a wry smile. "You don't know unpleasantness. Step inside, detective. You might change your frame of mind." "It did for them. Isn't that right, Officer Smith?" Smith offered me a pale expression, gulping and nodding, but still summoning the strength to lean forward and seize the boy's arm.
"Come on," Smith ordered, "to the station."
As Sam was dragged to the front stairs of the porch, he hauled the blanket over his head, continuing to hiss and sneer relentlessly. With every passing second, that fragile, broken boy seemed to slip away, being replaced by something sinister. "What's that about?" Lucy asked, joining me on the porch. I shrugged, watching as Smith and Carlson fought to shove the kid into the back of their vehicle. But once I was certain that he had been safely put inside the car, I beckoned for Lucy to join me inside. "A couple of the officers warned me that," she began. She didn't finish her sentence. Lucy and I stood horrified, in awe, as we witnessed a sickening spectacle within the large entryway of the Hull household. Hanging from the branches of the chandeliers were nooses, and within each the limp, lifeless bodies of Sam's university friends. But most horrifying of all, the bottom half of their corpses were missing. They were no more than torsos swinging in a lobby, and the floor beneath was coated in an even thicker, larger pool of blood than that at Lizzie Carter's house.
"I think," Lucy said, clasping her mouth. "No, I'm okay. There'll be time to throw up later," I said quietly.
"What the heck's happening here?" Lucy asked. "Do you really think that boy did all of this? Killed Lizzie too? In one night?"
I sighed. "I don't know. This is just..."
I trailed off, walking toward the pool of blood in the middle of the floor. I'd spotted something in the murky waste. Well, several things. White, glistening shapes that were eerily familiar. And when I plunged my hand into the drying liquid, I found three large fangs. One for each of the victims hanging from the chandelier, I thought to myself.
"Are those more teeth?" Lucy asked.
I nodded.
"Yep."
Lucy gulped, radioing the chief to fill him in on the events that had transpired. I really wanted to believe that we'd caught the maniac behind the night's events, but something just didn't feel right about the whole thing. The fear in the boy's face that had turned to a haunting look of evil as the pupils of his eyes changed. And as we stepped out onto the hall property, I was certain, if only for a moment, that I'd caught one of the victim's half-bodies twitching. "Couldn't have been," I told myself, as Lizzie and I returned to the car.
My eyes never tricked me. Upon Lucy's request, I went home and took a nap. I hadn't slept in about 30 hours, and my usually sharp brain was starting to falter. Thoughts felt hazy and difficult to grasp. But when I woke from my nap around 6 p.m., I felt no different. And I realized the confusion had nothing to do with sleep deprivation. It was this inexplicable case. Lucy, I called my radio, meeting down at the station. Silence from the other end. Great, I muttered, peeling myself from the sofa and grabbing my coat. Never answers when you need her. As I drove through town on that wintry night, I became aware of the place's stillness. Eerily still for that time of year. Christmas, in our quaint little paradise, was often a time of month-long celebration. I'd never seen a December night so quiet. Where was everybody? Chief? I spoke into my radio again. Any developments? Silence. I realized that my radio had been silent for the duration of the car journey. Earlier in the day, it had been buzzing every other minute, and suddenly there was nothing. Not only that, but no answer. I come from a sleepy town, but we're not that lax. My gut was churning fiercely as I pulled into the police station car park. I reached into my pocket for my gun, sensing that something was terribly wrong. But that trusty revolver would be no use. I stepped foot into a silent police station. Hello, I called. Anybody? I heard a distant door slamming and something clattering. Who's there? I asked, raising my firearm. I'll shoot. But you're all alone, detective. A voice hissed. It came from behind me, and I turned to see in the doorway a tall man, an abnormally tall man. His skin was white and papery, his eyes bloodshot beyond explanation, and behind him, the boy, Sam. Without warning, I unloaded the entire clip straight into the man's body, and inexplicably, every bullet passed through his supernatural ethereal form, vanishing into the night air. He smiled. What is this? I asked before calling out. Back up? Anyone? A weight fell on my back and suddenly brought me falling backwards through the feeble wooden desk in the reception area. And I rolled over on the floor to find myself facing a ghost, Lucy Carter. The old woman whose body had, 24 hours previous, been demolished beyond recognition. And yet, she was very much alive to my eyes, pinning me down and hissing above me with large, menacing fangs. Lizzie, I cried. It's me. Joe, she growled. Stop fighting. Just let me feed. I yelled, pushing the woman upwards, but finding beyond all explanation that she was unnaturally strong. Those menacing, terrible teeth were closing on my neck. No, I screamed, shoving her to the side. And through some incredible twist of luck or fate, the corpse of my once friend screamed in agony as it fell onto a large, upturned plank of wood, a sizable fragment of the broken desk. It pierced her torso through the middle, tearing through her heart. I watched as the demonic entity screeched, the deceased form disintegrating before my very eyes, finally being laid to rest. And I came to a realization that seemed ludicrous, nonsensical. I could scarcely put it to words. Vampires. I pulled myself to my feet, throwing my revolver to the side, and scooped up another large plank of wood. The tall man and Sam were gone, but I could hear commotion deeper in the police station. The voice of a familiar woman, Lucy. I clambered over the wreckage of the reception desk and burst through the door of the main hallway, scurrying down the darkened corridor. The silence of the police station was slowly replaced with a growing chorus of screams, crunches, and gunshots. And as I entered the main operating area, I found myself faced with a diabolical scene of destruction. The teenagers from the prior night's mass massacre were full-bodied and happily feasting on several of the officers, and Lucy was holed up in the office of Chief Anderson and Carlson. Her eyes widened as she saw me, and in a fit of adrenaline-fueled madness, I lunged at the distracted teenagers. I plunged my makeshift stake through the back of the first, piercing his heart and turning him to dust. The two others met the same fate, seemingly caught off guard to do anything to fight my advances, though the last girl certainly tried, rushing directly into my awaiting stake. Seeing what I'd done, Lucy and the other officers dropped their weapons, fashioning their own wooden tools of destruction, and proceeding to fight the onslaught of vicious creatures. And then the tall man saw me, eyes squinting viciously, much as Sam's eyes had done earlier.
"You," he hissed, "you will pay."
The gangly creature paced across the floor towards me, lifting long, fearsome fingers into the air and swiftly knocking the wood plank out of my hands before proceeding to hoist me to my feet.
"I will drain you not only of your blood, but your morality," the man whispered, "and you will suffer a fate crueler than death. You will."
The man wheezed, pausing mid-sentence and looking down to find a wooden object piercing its heart. A lanky javelin constructed by the chief had apprehended the vile creature from behind. The tall man shrieked, dropping me to the ground and stumbling backward. His followers cried, fleeing from the police station, as their fearless leader broke into 1,000 pieces. And that long night finally ended. But the tall man's minions did not perish alongside of him. They terrorize us to this day. We're prepared now, of course, and yet, though they seem to fear us, they do not flee. They simply bide their time, looking for an invitation into our homes under the guise of, for example, a postman. And that brings me to the events of this evening. The Amazon delivery man, standing on my porch with a parcel I didn't order. I glanced through the peephole, his eyes were bloodshot and thirsty. I smiled, opening my front door. And before the creature could reckon with its fate, I released the wooden bolt on my crossbow directly into its chest, sighing heavily as the shrieking creature evaporated before my eyes. And that's why we don't answer the door to postal workers in my town anymore. But make no mistake, this is still very much our town. I hope you enjoyed No Post by Dominic Eagle, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, well, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dominic-Eagle. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/DOMINIC-EAGLE. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. At least law enforcement in this town has the right idea. Shoot first, make sure it was an actual delivery driver later. I'd be concerned, though, if suddenly little delivery drones started arriving in the middle of the night. I've heard vampire drones are getting more numerous by the day. Don't you hate it when sickness travels around? First it's at work, then at home, then comes back to you after it passes through everyone else. It's even worse in a small town because then there's a chance everybody and their cousin will get sick. But as Mike Edwards points out, sometimes people getting sick is just the beginning of one small town's problems. Without further ado, I present to you The Sleeper's Thirst. Isaiah had always thought that quarantines were supposed to keep you safe. He knew better now. Quarantines were just about establishing a separation. They kept everyone else safe by keeping the sick people contained. It was a logical way to do things. He probably even would have called it reasonable if he'd been on the other side of the quarantine barrier. From this side, though, it just looked like a death sentence. The worst part was that Isaiah wasn't even sick. That wasn't just his opinion, either. He'd been through a battery of tests proving it. Everyone in town had, by this point.
Not a day went by that the CDC scientists in their Tyvek bunny suits weren't there with their needles and swabs and specimen collection jars. They'd taken enough samples from Isaiah that he was pretty sure that they could just rebuild them on the far side of the barrier. Sometimes he liked to pretend they had. Then he could picture that alternate Isaiah moving on with his life, just walking away until Corson's Curve was nothing more than a dot on the horizon. He'd always sworn that he'd leave the tiny town behind one day. Now it was looking like he'd never get to. Corson's Curve had always been a nowhere place, barely more than a wide spot on the road it was named after. Technically, it wasn't even a town, just an unincorporated township, which was the official way of saying that it didn't matter. There was a gas station, a diner, and a church. The first two were to convince the people driving by to stop in for a while. The last one was to give the people stuck there a place to pray that they could leave. The gas station and the diner were closed these days. The church was full. It was the diner that had started the problem, more or less. At least that's what the government folks had come to investigate at first. They swarmed in one day, their rental cars all dusty from the drive, tapping away at their tablets until they closed down the diner, inspected all of its equipment, interviewed the McClellans about their safety and hygiene and standards. They didn't say why at first or tell anyone what they found. They just conferred for a while, telling Orv McClellan that he was clear to reopen, and left. The next day, a totally different agency descended on the gas station in what might have been the very same rental cars. They dug through the storage, plunged gauges into the tanks, and also refused to say what they were looking for. They left just as abruptly as the first group, and all of Corson's Curve was left scratching their heads and wondering what had just happened. Then, 2 days later, there were suddenly helicopters and plastic tents and a whole temporary city being set up right out there on County Road 74. They put up barricades about 5 miles out on either side and came through the town in hazmat suits, announcing that there was quarantine and that, for their own safety, no one was allowed to leave Corson's Curve. For their own safety. Isaiah snarled at that statement. They'd never been less safe. Just 3 days after the quarantine went up, the first person died. The first resident of Corson's Curve, anyway. It turned out that over the past few years, there'd been a number of unexplained cases of seemingly healthy people suddenly lapsing into comas. Some had woken up days or weeks later, others had not. A number of those who recovered remember stopping off for lunch at the diner in Corson's Curve. Credit card receipts confirmed that this had been true for many of the other cases as well. What's more, a number of missing persons had also purchased something from either the diner or the gas station in Corson's Curve as one of the final acts before their disappearance. The information had always been there to see, but no one ever collated it before. Requests for investigation were passed up bureaucratic chains, and first the FDA and then the EPA sent teams in to try to identify the mystery hazard in Corson's Curve. They found nothing immediately damning, and the report might as well have gone on to fill a hole in a file folder in a neglected cabinet, except that the night after returning home, one of the government inspectors fell asleep and didn't wake up. She was admitted to the hospital the next day in a comatose state, her symptoms matching those that had triggered the investigation in the first place. That kicked the anthill, sure enough. Random folks getting sick was merely a point of interest, but the government didn't take kindly to it happening to one of their own. They had the CDC out there the next day setting up those plastic tents for the beginning of what quickly became the quarantine zone. It was only supposed to be temporary until Orv dropped dead. Well, worse, until Orv dropped unconscious, same as the EPA lady. Same as all the others before. He was fine when he went to bed, but the next morning he just wouldn't wake up. His wife Deb ran to the white suits for help. It seemed reasonable at the time. They were doctors, after all. They had just spent the previous couple of days going through the diner testing for something, though they hadn't told her what. Orv spent just about all of his time in the diner,
what with being the owner, manager, head cook, and busboy. And of course, Deb was worried for herself, too. She was there just as much as Orv was. The government folks told her they'd handle it. They took Orv away on a stretcher. He was the very last resident to make it out of Corson's Curve. Isaiah reflected on how different things might have been if Orv hadn't gotten sick just then, or if Deb had just kept it quiet. The CDC had already done all of its testing that they could on the diner and the gas station. None of them had even come into town on that third day. They'd all been holed up in their mobile labs, peering at stuff under microscopes and finding nothing. Another day or two and they probably would have packed it in. Orv's affliction galvanized them. They drained all of the blood they could off of him, and when that still didn't show them anything, they went after the rest of the town. They came armed only with syringes and paperwork at first, telling everyone it was all to help one of their own. The town lined up nice and compliant, too. Everyone liked Orv, and if helping him meant giving up a little blood, well, then so be it. There was a little more pushback once folks became clear they weren't being allowed to leave town. Rumors and dissensions started to spread. This was still America, wasn't it? What right did these scientists have to lock them up like this? The government sent a man around to calm people down, to assure them it was only temporary. Isaiah met him in the yard. He noted the stark difference between his own stained and worn coveralls and the man's crisp, white, disposable protective gear. He just liked the government man on sight. "Hi, my name's Bolton. I'm with the CDC." His voice was muffled by his mask. He stuck out his hand, but when Isaiah made no move to shake it, he dropped it and went on. "Look, I know there's been some concern." "You fixed up Orv yet?" Isaiah interrupted. "No, but we're... Can we leave?" "Soon, but..." "Then we've got nothing to say to each other." Isaiah turned back to the tree he was pruning. "I know you're upset, but I promise." "You think I'm interested in your promises?" Isaiah turned and poked at him with a tree trimmer, enjoying how the man flinched back from the sharp blades. "You come around here and tell us that everything's fine, everything's safe, and meanwhile, you won't even breathe the same air as us. Tell you what, let me put a little hole in that suit of yours. Let you be a lab rat in your own experiment. Then we'll see what your promises are worth." He poked at Bolton again to emphasize his point just as the man put his hands up in a placating gesture. The tip of the blade cut right across the palm of Bolton's glove. Bolton's eyes went wide with horror behind his mask. He ran for his car with his hands clamped in his opposite armpit, but not before Isaiah saw the stain, the bright stain of red, where he'd made contact. He felt a little bad. He hadn't actually meant to hurt the man. Still, he'd be lying if he said he hadn't enjoyed the fear on Bolton's face. It might even do the government man a bit of good, help him understand why the people in Corson's Curve were so concerned. Gravel sprayed as Bolton peeled out of the driveway. Isaiah watched him disappear around a curve of the long drive and was just turning back to his tree when he heard a crash. Dropping the trimmer, he hustled down the driveway to find Bolton's car crumpled up against the tree, steam coming from the hood. The man himself was still in the car, unconscious. The airbag had deployed, and at first, Isaiah assumed that it must have knocked Bolton out. But try as he might, he couldn't get the man to wake up. The pulse was fine. His breathing was steady. He was just utterly unresponsive. Isaiah turned the car off. He unbuckled Bolton and leaned his seat back. He watched him for a long time and thought about what to do. When he finally concluded that the man was simply not going to wake up, Isaiah walked back to get his own car and go fetch help. He didn't go to the CDC encampment. He'd seen what happened when Deb had reported Orv's coma to them, after all. Instead, he went to the church to find Pastor Adams. Isaiah didn't even bother to go inside the church when he arrived. It was a pleasant day, and he knew that both the sanctuary and the office would be empty. He found Adams exactly where he knew he would be, in the church graveyard, sitting under the red leaves of the Japanese maple that marked his wife's grave. The pastor looked up at the creak of the iron gate. He rose upon seeing Isaiah and walked down to meet him. "Good evening." He saw the troubled look on Isaiah's face. "Or perhaps simply evening?" can I do for you? A man came by to talk about the quarantine today. Yes, he was going to all of the houses. Well, not after mine, he wasn't. Isaiah related what had happened. When he reached the part where he'd cut Bolton's hand, the pastor grimaced. Something wrong? Isaiah asked. I assume this story ends with this man collapsing and refusing to wake? Well, I assumed that that had more to do with the car crash and the knock on his head, but yeah, how did you know? Adam sighed heavily. You recall when Maribel took ill? Of course. The whole town had rallied around the pastor's wife when she got sick. That had been more than a decade ago, though, and to the best of Isaiah's knowledge, had never involved a coma. But I don't. Adams held his hand up. Peace. You will. When Maribel got sick, we tried everything. Doctors, herbalists, prayer, of course. The disease only tightened its grip. He shook his head. We were grasping at straws when she found the treatment. It was total snake oil, a ridiculous scam to prey on the dying. But I saw hope in Maribel's eyes, and I could not say no. I stole from the church to afford the price, praying to God that he'd forgive me. I ground up the roots and the herbs that they sent me. I cooked them all together according to the precise instructions. I told myself it was medicine and the steps merely a recipe like a pharmacist might follow. I ignored the voice in my head that insisted this was witchcraft. The next day was a miracle. Color had come back to her face, energy to her body. And though it faded quickly over the course of the day and through the next day, saw her back in bed entirely, I attribute it simply to overexerting herself. And how could I not? The following day she was bright and healthy again, almost as she had been before the illness. She waxed and waned over the next few weeks, but even the low days were better than she'd been before. I dared to hope. Then I caught her. I found her bent over the corpse of a traveler, a stranger she'd abducted. Her face was buried within his ripped-open chest, and his body grew whiter even as I watched. She greedily sucked the blood from his heart, and when I pulled her away, she didn't fight except to keep the heart pressed to her lips. I knew then that what I had done was unholy. I prayed that I might still fix it. I tied her to the bed and kept her there no matter how she thrashed and pleaded, no matter how pale and drawn she got, no matter how desperate her cries. She vomited up any food or medicine I gave her, and she cried for the one thing that could sustain her, the one thing I could not allow. I watched my wife waste away and die, and although she begged me to save her life, to feed her the blood of another, she never cursed me when I could not bring myself to do it. Her final words were ones of love. I buried her in the church graveyard, and I hoped that God would take her into his kingdom. He turned to look at the blood-red leaves of the tree that sprouted from a grave. When I saw this sign, I hoped it meant that he had. Isaiah cast a nervous glance at the tree. Its leaves glowed in the setting sun. The redness seemed to drip from its leaves, staining the graves and the ground below. The pastor continued. I soon learned that it meant he had not. Maribel was dead and buried, yet not 2 weeks later, I discovered another corpse, a young woman drained of blood. When I tried to roll her over, I found a root piercing her back, affixing her to the ground. I swore I saw the root twitch when I pulled the body free. I should have reported it. Instead, I buried the body under the maple and hoped it would be satiated. It wasn't enough. It was never enough. How many bodies did you bury, Pastor? Isaiah asked quietly. Too many, he said sadly. After the first one, I didn't know how to stop. Any inquiry would uncover my complicity, the bodies I had hidden. Maribel continued to catch those she could, but I comforted myself in the belief that she was careful and that she cared for us. She never turned on the town. She protected us. Except for Orv, said Isaiah. Something's wrong lately, said Adams. The scientists, the investigators, she's agitated, striking out. She never took so many so incautiously. She never hurt one of us. But now she is, so what do we do? Adams gave another agonized look toward the tree. I think first we find our latest victim. Let's go get Mr. Bolton. To save, Pastor, or to bury? The pastor didn't clarify. After a silent ride back to his house, Isaiah found that the question didn't matter. Although Bolton's car was still there, the man himself was gone. The door to the car stood open. The gravel of the driveway bore no sign of where the man might have gone. The woods loomed dark and ominous on either side. "You think the government folks found him?" asked Isaiah. "Call the town," said Adams. "Call everyone. Tell them to come to the church. Tell them that the CDC demanded it, or that we're making a plan to prepare our freedom. Anything. Whatever they need to hear, just tell them to come now." Isaiah let the pastor drive back. He sent texts and made calls, instructing others to do the same. By the time they'd made it back to the church, the people of Corson's Curve were already starting to gather. "Inside," said the pastor, and no one dared to argue. As the people filed in, whispering to each other, Isaiah heard another noise coming from the graveyard. It was a shuffling, scratching noise, the sound of digging. The moonlight showed no one among the graves, but the tree over Maribel's grave shook in the wind that nothing else seemed to feel, and the grass heaved slightly as if being pushed at from underneath. Isaiah turned away and focused on ushering everyone inside as swiftly and safely as possible. It was a tight fit, but the church sanctuary was large and the population of Corson's Curve was small. Maribel's tree was swaying noticeably by the time the last of the town filed inside, but Isaiah kept the latecomers organized and moving forward. When he shut the doors, the light and sound in the crowded church was a welcome relief. People were gathered in 100 buzzing knots of conversation, all discussing what they thought they knew and why they thought they were here. All conversations quieted as Pastor Adams addressed them from the chancel. "It's been a challenging week," he said. "You're no doubt looking for answers. For one night more, I ask you to accept ignorance. There are things you do not know. There are things you must not know. In the morning, we'll all walk together to the barricades surrounding our town, and we'll ask them to release us from this imprisonment. Armored in our faith, they cannot deny us. And if they do," someone yelled from the congregation. "Then at least we'll outnumber them," said the pastor, which drew a ripple of laughter. He paused for a moment as if considering what else to say, then stepped down to join the town in the nave of the church. There was a brief surge of confused chatter, but as the pastor walked among the people of Corson's Curve, speaking calmly and openly, the questions faded away. "What's the plan?" asked Isaiah, once he found a moment alone with the pastor. "Just as I said, we march as a town tomorrow and request our release. But tonight, we're in the house of God tonight. Is that enough, Pastor?" "I hope so." As the evening wore on, the conversations quieted and eventually died out entirely. People began to stretch out and go to sleep. A few drifted back toward the doors, looking to leave, but Isaiah had posted himself by then. "It's not a good idea," was all he said to anyone who approached. It earned him some uncertain looks, but no questions. No one knew what was happening, but it was clear to everyone that something was. The night was long, but uneventful. Isaiah sat with his back to the doors and eventually slept. His dreams were fitful but undisturbed. Most of the people were stirring by the time the morning sun began to peek through the church's windows. Isaiah could hear nothing but birdsong outside the church's doors. At a nod from Pastor Adams, he opened them and led the town outside. He looked back to see the people streaming through the open doors and saw that the Japanese maple in the graveyard had toppled to the ground in a sea of disturbed earth. He said nothing and instead turned to face the distant white tents. The arrival at the quarantine zone was anticlimactic. The tents were empty, their flaps waving gently in the morning breeze. The equipment inside sat idle. The barricades in the road were unmanned. "Where'd they all go?" the people asked each other. No one had an answer. Eventually, everyone collected their cars and drifted off in separate directions, still discussing what had gone on. Some had called it a miracle. Others insisted it was coincidence. Isaiah, for his part, went back to the graveyard and studied the upturned ground. The fallen tree was half sunken in churned dirt. Dozens of sets of footprints marred the ground, mostly covered by long, dragged grooves. He dug briefly at the earth, moving the loose soil aside, until he found a white, bloodless hand. It was pierced with thin roots. As the sunlight hit the fingers, they gave a microscopic twitch. Isaiah pushed the dirt back in place. He stood, brushed the graveyard soil from his pants, and made his way back to his truck. By the time the sun set that night, Corson's Curve was no more than a dot on the horizon. I hope you enjoyed The Sleeper's Thirst by Micah Edwards, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented feature author, well, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Micah-Edwards. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/MICAH-EDWARDS. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. You recall the Lorax, don't you? He used to speak for the trees. Well, I believe we've found a tree that is able to speak for itself, even without saying a word. For our fourth and final tale, we turn again to another small town, but take heart, this one's troubles are not quite so widespread. No, we're going to hear from a gentleman who has more than a few memories to recount, but none quite so impressive as one this town left on him. And maybe it'll make its mark on you, too. Without further ado, I present to you, There's a Place Down the Road. Time's a funny thing. On the one hand, I look at my kids and grandkids, and I realize that years have passed and that I'm exactly as old as I think I am. On the other, there are things that happened damn near 50 years ago that I can recall like they happened yesterday. Long since retired, you know. Met my wife when I was in my late 20s, and I spent most of my career dealing with the growth of the computer field. I went from installing Apples to Commodores to IBMs for various businesses, and finally got out of it around the time everyone started staring at their phones instead of each other. Shame. I love technology, but I don't like what it does to the mind when people think that's all they have to offer to each other. Facebook? It's great for knowing what little Richie ate for breakfast this morning. But I can't have a debate on it. Life's too short for arguing with people who won't look you in the face. No, I have my place out in the country. That's a happy life now. Several acres, green grass, a little farm, couple dogs, two horses that only know my wife knows how to ride, and my woodworking. Along with the visits from the family, I think I've made out pretty good. It's humble, it's comforting, and that's all I need. But then there's what happened all those years ago. The thing everyone always wants to know from me. The crazy story that Gramps tells, the one when he was just a kid. Well, I wouldn't say I was a kid then. I was in college, or more accurately, I was on summer break and I was this close to dropping out. I had had enough of the math and logic of my computer coursework, and I decided that maybe I should do some traveling on my own to find myself. It was the summer of 77, as you might recall. A very famous film by George Lucas had come out that year. Actually, it was a few months before my little trip, and it had inspired me in ways I could only imagine. The big screen, the jump to hyperspace, the guy sitting next to me who dropped his popcorn when it happened. The two necking in the corner who couldn't have cared what happened, if Luke and Han rescued the princess or not. The 12-year-olds in front of me, who had seen the movie 6 times now, and had stolen money from their dad's wallet to see it again. These are the things I remember most about it. That's really it, isn't it? There are moments we all share, but our own ways of experiencing it. I'm sure most people today have never seen a Star Wars film on the big screen, just on their phones or streamed to a TV. But it's like Facebook. The convenience doesn't have the same togetherness as that dingy theater with the crummy mono sound and the collection of humanity from all walks of life, watching the same thing. But as much as it pains me, this isn't a story about that wonderful start to the summer. What I'm about to talk about is the stop I made during my little walk across America. I would normally say it's something I would prefer to forget, but then, well, that's an interesting part of the story, and allow me to get to it. I started off with what cash I had in hand. Not a bad amount for a college student, but certainly not enough to even consider renting a car, and did what they tell you not to do anymore. I took up hitchhiking. Now, on my way, I rode with some weird people, I won't lie. But it's a shame that such a thing is frowned upon. I personally never felt unsafe, but then again, I was a young guy, mostly clean-shaven, and I kept myself in decent shape, so that could have been a deterrent. But at the same time, I was picked up by a surprisingly number of young women as well, who probably thought they'd found boyfriend material. None of them worked out. The closest I ever got was lunch at a highway burger joint. But while nowadays I couldn't pick their names out of a lineup, I remember all their faces so well. The most memorable jaunt of the whole trip, though, was Rollins. Rollins drove a pickup truck. I don't even know the model, since all the logos had long since fallen off and the thing was dirtier than the magazine rack at an adult bookstore. But Rollins himself was exactly the kind of guy you'd imagine when you think of the late 70s. Ball cap with a plastic mesh backing, blue sleeveless puffy vest, flannel shirt, jeans you could strike a match off of, curly brown hair that only stayed in shape because the cap held it there, and brown eyes that always regarded you with suspicion. I liked him the moment he shook my hand. He looked young, but I guess he was probably in his 40s. He talked about family back home, that he was normally a big rig driver, hauling it across the country, barely even recognized his kids when he saw them because they always jumped up a foot or two since the last time he stopped at the house. Right now, though, his union had decided to go on strike, and rather than risk stepping on any picket lines, well, he bought a used truck for about $40 and used it to drive back home for the time being. I personally thought he'd paid a little too much, but he was a good conversationalist. Loved movies, and even though his Odyssey had broken a few months ago, his kids were getting very excited about the Atari, and they probably would have bought one for Christmas. But when he told me the price, I asked him if they offered layaway options. It wasn't long before we rambled into a small town. Decent main street. Neighborhoods scattered behind, quaint atmosphere. The roads were paved, which helped a lot, and Rollins told me he was going to stop for some gas if I wanted to grab a bite to eat. After asking if I could grab a burger for him as well, I walked down the street. It was quiet here, though there were a few cars that went by, and what locals were out seemed friendly enough. One kid, maybe about 14 or so, was sitting on a bench reading a comic. When I asked where the closest place to eat was, he looked up at me, adjusted his sunglasses, and pointed a little ways down the road. It's called Pops. Can't miss it. I thanked him and moved on, eventually finding the whitewashed storefront with a dilapidated screen door. It opened with a screech of old hinges and nearly snapped on my feet before I got inside. The space didn't allow for seating. All that was there was a wire rack filled with bagged chips, a countertop for ordering, and a massive, wall-length grill, being attended by a shirtless man with an apron who I assumed was Pops. It was sweltering inside, so I couldn't fault his lack of shirt, but I was glad he still had his jeans on. Over the din of the grill, Pops asked me for my order, and I tried my best to order some burgers for myself and Rollins. Now, I'm not going to tell you what it cost, because there's a good chance if you realized you once could pay for a burger and some fries with pocket change, your heads would probably explode. I'd barely finished paying for them, and getting a greasy paper bag in exchange with two paper-wrapped sandwiches and two scoops of fries dumped in, when I heard a voice. Passing through, stranger? She was young and pretty and waiting by the door, supposedly for a burger of her own. But I never saw her get food. It seemed to be an excuse just to talk to me, though other than actually going into the shop, I didn't know what about me drew her attention. I was dirty from the road, hadn't had a shower in a day or two, hadn't shaved in a day either. But maybe that was exactly what she was looking for. She sat with me on a bench outside, and we talked. I barely remember everything we talked about, but then again, it was all small talk, nothing of any real consequence. I know she called me cute a few times, funny once. Her pink-rimmed sunglasses held her hair out of her eyes as she talked. I don't know how much time passed, but I do remember Rollins finally coming up to us, swearing a storm and a half, talking about the cheap garbage pickup truck. It didn't start when he filled it up, and it looked like it would have to be in the shop a few days. He apologized and said he wouldn't be upset if I hightailed it out of town with somebody else. Looking at the scant few cars, I actually wondered if leaving without them was a possibility to begin with. Cars passed through, sure, but none ever seemed to stay or stop for longer than it took to wait out a light. I told him maybe we should grab a place in town for a few nights, see the sights, and we'd go when things got better. He seemed appreciative enough for the company and even offered to pay for my room once we found a place to stay. The girl said there was a motel just off the main street, nothing special, just a couple of rooms, but they did have vacancy. We thanked her and we walked over. And she wasn't kidding when she said it was a small place and that it was nothing special. Gray paint flaked from the walls and there were four rooms, two upstairs and two down. It wasn't even a lobby. The front desk was a window that overlooked the street. And the owner, a doughy fellow with graying temples named Glenn, who reminded me a lot of Elvis, took our money gladly and showed us to our rooms. The outside was nothing to look at, but the inside, well, it was something at least. It was clean, nice sheets, if a little dated looking. A TV in the corner, bathroom slightly yellowed from age, but otherwise serviceable. My room was upstairs while Rollins had the one directly underneath mine. I debated if I should just settle in and relax for the rest of the day, but wanderlust got the better of me, and I decided even if the town wasn't much, who knew what little secrets it might hold. Even if I saw, well, all that I saw was the world's greatest taco stand, well, that would still be something, wouldn't it? The town itself was relatively small, just the main street, some houses, and then some light suburbs before disappearing out into grassland beyond. But unlike most people who saw endless expanse like that boring, I loved it. The fresh wind blowing in my face, the distant thrum of cars in the freeway beyond, the rustle of the grass. It felt like being caught up in something divine, standing there with nothing but the shirt on my back and a few dollars in my pocket. That was also the direction of the cemetery. While the town itself looked aged, worn in, rough but serviceable, the cemetery was an odd mix of both the well-maintained and the dilapidated. The gates were rusted, broken down, with a lock that couldn't hold a refrigerator shut, but many of the tombs themselves looked pristine. Now, don't get me wrong, much of it was old. Some stone had text that was barely legible. But you'd have thought from the front gate that it would have been overgrown and moldy. But no, the stone mausoleums were well maintained and the paths easily trod. I also didn't feel alone there. Again, you might look at me and say, well, of course, it's a graveyard. There are hundreds there, even if they aren't alive. But that's not what I meant. The place felt vibrant in a way the town did not, even though both were equally quiet. I never felt like I was in danger in the bright midday sun, but I did feel nervous about being here by myself, holding nothing but the Polaroid camera I'd brought in the event I wanted to get pictures. I did snap a few, waving the pictures as they came out. I'd heard shaking them didn't actually do anything important, but I didn't care. It was fun, and everyone did it. But the shots I did get have a very artistic bent to them. That was the extent of my fun, though. I returned back to town after that, checked in with Rollins to make sure he was okay, then grabbed another burger and a bag of fries for dinner to eat in front of the TV. I woke up, empty bag still next to me, with Johnny Carson still playing. I wondered why I'd woken up, then realized there was knocking on my door. Groggy and less concerned than I should have been, thinking maybe Rollins had got word his car was fixed, I pulled the curtain back slightly to see. It was the girl from the afternoon. I slid back the chain and opened it up. "Hi. Did you need something?" "Well, you could say that. What are you doing, stranger?" "I'm sleeping, but I guess I'm catching the end of Carson. Or we can see what's on ABC late night. If we're lucky, we'll catch Charlie's Angels and not Barney Miller." "Well, can I come in?" I waved a hand, and she came in, sitting on the end of my bed, staring at the TV. She was almost hypnotized by it, I realized, like it was something she didn't watch all that much. I sat down next to her. "Everything all right?" Yes, I'm fine." She said it in a way that suggested that no, she was not fine. "Do you ever have a feeling like you can't go home again?" "I'm actually trying to avoid home for a little bit. Not that it's a bad place, but I just need to see something else." "Oh." She still had those sunglasses, pushing her hair back, almost like they were glued to her forehead. "See, I wish I could go home, but I can't. They don't want me there." I put my arm on her shoulder. She didn't resist. "Why wouldn't they?" "Well, they think of me as a disappointment. I'm not what they wanted me to be." "And they kicked you out?" No, I left before they could, and that's why I'm here." "I guess we can't all be lucky." I felt a tinge of guilt for my rambling ways, despite my happy home life, when here was someone who had nothing of comfort. "Well, you have a home here, right? Someone who can take care of you?" "Sort of. They say they like me, but I think they just sort of tolerate me being here." She leaned on me, and I rubbed her shoulder, not really knowing what else to do. "Well, thank you for confiding in me. Even though I don't really know you, and it's after midnight, and this is a room I've got for a few nights before I move on again." She raised an arm and wrapped it around my shoulder. Would you be upset if we spent the rest of the night together?" And there it was. I was alone and on the road, looking to experience the world, and here was an opportunity I never expected in a million years, literally falling into my lap. The evening beyond that point was a blur. At first, there was just television watching. Then we leaned close to each other on the bed, then hands and lips touching. Clothes began to vanish, soft flesh pressed against each other. A deep embrace, her mouth pressed close to me, kissing ever more passionately. Then it was morning. I woke. My clothes were scattered around the room. The TV was still on. My things were still there, but she was gone. I still don't know her name. Perhaps I'd never know. I got out of bed and wandered into the bathroom to clean up. I looked in the mirror before I went to wash my face. I stopped, puzzled. I knew it had been a while since I shaved, but there was no way I picked up that much beard overnight. I also noticed that I looked a little more ragged than usual, like I hadn't slept well in a week, but I felt just fine. My arms were a little weak maybe, but that was about it. I got up my Norelco and took on my beard as best I could and went downstairs to check on Rollins. I knocked, but got no answer. He must have already been down at the mechanic's place to check on the truck. I wandered down there, but Rollins was nowhere to be found. I went to see the mechanic to see what the news there was. Like I told the other guy, it's going to be a few days, but the part hasn't come in yet. Best to just wait it out. I understand it's a rough situation, but hey, you should be okay for a few days yet, right? I hated to admit it, since I really had nowhere I needed to be, but there was still an air of something being off. First, Rollins wasn't here either, and I don't know where else he would have gone to if his car still wasn't working. I decided to call home just to let him know there was nothing to worry about. I went back to the motel, but there was no phone in the room. Odd, but nothing I would have considered unusual at the time, at least compared to everything else going on. I did eventually come across a payphone, set up a little on the outskirts of town on the way to the cemetery. Pulled out a few dimes and dropped them in, not finding any nickels in my pocket, and called. My sister answered. We had a nice conversation, but then I began to tell her about the truck. Yeah, the guy driving me is pretty nice, but unfortunately the part isn't in yet. We should be out of here by Thursday. Thursday? That's a whole other week. You sure you could afford to stay there until then? I wrinkled my brow. Thursday's tomorrow. You haven't been doing anything legal, have you, big brother? It's Friday. Nah, that didn't make sense. We got here on Tuesday. How could have I missed 2 whole days? What she said made me wonder, though. I wasn't one to hit the dope like some friends of mine, but maybe that girl, could she have hit me with something I didn't know about? Whatever it was, something to knock me out cold for a few days would have been something else. But then I would have expected Rollins to be concerned about my well-being instead of me being worried about him. I tried his hotel room again after I hung up, but still no answer. I checked the desk, and Glenn said he hadn't noticed anyone go in or out, just me. I went back to my room and racked my brains trying to make sense of all this. I didn't know what to do, except maybe flag somebody else passing through and trying to make sense of this down the road. But if something had happened to Rollins, I didn't want to abandon him either. Strangely, I found I didn't really want to do much of anything, really. I felt lethargic, out of it. And once I sat down on the bed, all I really wanted to do was sit there and watch TV. The only thing I really tried to do was deadbolt my door, and so I sat, watching the local news, the primetime comedies, and then it was nighttime and Carson came on. Then the knocking. Hey, it's me. Open the door. I finally got the strength to get up and look out the window. It was her. She seemed excited to see me, but considering the situation, I was less interested. Hey, I'm tired. I think I'm going to call it a night. I watched her face fall with disappointment, but then I saw something else flicker. Oh, don't be like that. I thought we really had something, you and me. Please, can we just talk? No, I don't really feel like it tonight. I think you should go. I saw that flicker again. Her lip trembled. Then she hit the door with her fist hard. The door bounced in its frame. Then I knew something was truly wrong. She had a slight build, light, and yet the door was metal, heavy. It shouldn't have budged. I back away from the window. No, please, let me in. Your mind is so happy. You don't understand. I've never met someone like you. Everyone that comes through is always trying to escape something, just like me. But you're just enjoying life. You have no idea how it tastes. How it tastes? And that one phrase, adrenaline coursed through me, and my lethargy disappeared. I dug through my things until I found something I thought I wouldn't need. I bought it off a guy outside a drugstore, a butterfly knife. Illegal in so many places, but something told me if I ever ran into trouble, where I got it would be a lot less important than staying alive. I flipped it open, gripping it tight as the hammering got harder and faster, until the door could take no more and flew open. The deadbolt, still locked, pulled the entire door frame with it, and she stalked into the room. The pretty face was gone. This was an old, worn face, but not what I expected. Her eyes had swollen into an almost insectoid shape, pressing the glasses away from her forehead, and her mouth opened. Two shapes emerged from it like fangs, but these looked more like straws with sharp points on them instead of any of the teeth I'd ever seen. She lunged, pinning me back, straws descending on me, trying to dig their way behind my back, and I could feel them pulsing and wiggling as they tried to push into my skin just where the shoulder blades met. I started thrusting with a knife, hitting soft tissue in her stomach. She screamed and retreated, hissing in pain. But when those inhuman eyes stared back at me, I didn't see anger. I saw pain, sorrow, and sadness. I couldn't take the time to process it, though. I was too frightened, too thrown off by the sight of this thing, that I took my advantage and threw myself at her, pinning her to the ground, stabbing the knife in those eyes, her chest, her throat, anywhere the blade could find home. She gurgled and gasped, and finally she fell silent. I watched a thick green ooze pour from her wounds, not blood, but something wholly alien. I watched and waited for a bit, but she didn't get back up. Whatever this thing was, I felt quite sure it was dead. With that commotion, I thought for certain that Glenn or Rollins would have heard something and come to check, but there was nothing. Nothing but silence. Grabbing a lamp from my room and unplugging it, I went downstairs and smashed open the window to Rollins' room. His things were still there, but he wasn't. But what I did see was the sign of a struggle, meaning whatever had happened, he'd put up a fight. But I saw no blood or other signs of violence. I went to Glenn's window. He wasn't there, so I climbed over the ledge, looking for a phone to call. I found no phone, but I did find something else. A trapdoor hidden to look like the carpet, but with the handle that could easily open and close it. Inside was a ladder leading down into darkness. I went back to my room, got my emergency military-style flashlight that could hook onto a pocket and shine out hands-free, and I went down it. The tunnel was long. It smelled musty, old, but at the same time, it seemed well kept. It took some time, but I eventually came out into a large room. I heard the shuffling before I actually saw any of the inhabitants, and my flashlight finally caught them. There were at least a dozen, pale, hissing, as the light hit them, but they did not recoil in pain. I recognized Glenn, I recognized Pops, but more than that, I recognized the fangs they had. Those things were unmistakable. I'd seen too many Hammer movies to know what I was looking at, and I realized how in over my head I was and how likely I was to die right there and now. I held up my knife and they pulled back. I didn't know why at first, because it was just one man with a blade against many, but then I realized the handle with its shiny surface must have been more valuable than I first realized. Silver. Pure silver. I held it in front of me, finger going across the other side of the knife, making a cross. It worked, just like I'd seen Christopher Lee do in so many movies. They backed away from a holy symbol, and I almost tripped over the shape of the ground. Rollins, he was pale, covered in small round bites, but he still wheezed. He was alive. I don't know how they were sustaining him, but I didn't care. I grabbed him by the arm and pulled. After a few feet, I tried to lift him, and somehow, despite how weak he must have been, he found the strength to stand. He leaned on me, and I carried him out through that tunnel. I faced behind us the whole way, holding that silver knife in front of me, as we left whatever cavern that must have existed under that cemetery. The night after that was a blur again, as I wondered how we'd get up the ladder, but just the knowledge that he wasn't going to die down in that hole gave him the power to climb. He leaned on me once more, once we emerged, and we walked down the highway, heading back to the main road.
We must have passed out once we reached the freeway because I woke up in the hospital. Rollins was discharged before I was, having suffered from anemia, but fully recovered within a day or so. Me, on the other hand, well, my case was a little different. My blood was intact, but I seemed to be missing large quantities of cerebrospinal fluid. The doctors explained to me that they found two holes near the base of my neck where it would have been extracted, but were at a loss as to how or why they were made. They said that until my levels had returned to a normal amount, though, they wanted to keep me for more testing. However, when they finally released me, the only thing I suffered from was mild memory loss. I never recovered what happened on those missing days, and there were a few other things I don't recall to this day. My 6th and 7th birthdays are gone, as is the day my sister was born. And oddly enough, I cannot remember two things that are utterly convenient for people other than myself. For all my memories of that town, I cannot recall exactly what the girl looked like, other than her sunglasses and that awful face that attacked me with its sucking tubes, and I can't remember what the name of the town was or where it was located. Sadly, Rollins wouldn't be telling anybody if he knew. Though he was reunited with his family, the strike ended shortly after and he began trucking again. One night he drove off the road and his truck crashed in a ravine. He was killed on impact. I still don't know if it was an accident or the memories of what he suffered just turned out to be too much. But I believe what she told me. I don't know exactly what she was, but she wasn't like the people in that town. But they tolerated her because if she drained memories, what better way to cover the dark deeds they did with those that stayed in the town too long? I do know, through research in my later years, that unlike the movie vampires, they were probably more like Stoker's classic tale, capable of moving in daylight, just without their natural powers, and that just makes me more vigilant. I may not know where that town was anymore, and it's been many years since, and I've yet to encounter any problems. I just hope they keep to themselves. But for the sake of my family, I'll be ready should they ever decide to leave and come looking for me. Well, now I've gone prattling on too long. Can I interest you in any of my fine wood carvings? I hope you enjoyed There's a Place Down the Road as performed by yours truly. As always, a big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference, and it would mean a lot to us. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back 10 years to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groeschel. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?